Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Martha Park, whose new book is World Without End, Essays on Apocalypse and After. Martha Park is a writer and illustrator from Memphis, Tennessee. She received her MFA from the Jackson Center for Creative Writing at Hollins University, and she's been widely published in such periodicals as Orion, The Oxford American, The Guardian, and The Bitter Southerner. Today, we're talking about her first book of essays, World Without End, Essays on Apocalypse and After. Martha Park, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is such a beautiful book in the very literal sense, because you are an artist. And here are your sketches and end papers and that gorgeous painting on the cover. So you're a double threat as a writer.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been such a joy to get to make art for the book and to just see it cohere as kind of a singular object. I feel like I've heard stories from friends in publishing that didn't get to be as involved in kind of the creation of the book and the aesthetic of the book, and I just feel like my fingerprints are all over it.
So talk about why you chose this painting for the cover, which is so beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, the cover has kind of a portrait of two roseate spoonbills, and they appear later in the book. I'm researching the possible reappearance of the ivory-billed woodpecker in Arkansas about 20 years ago, and I noticed the use of the word resurrection a lot when people talked about the ivory bill and when they talked about its habitat. And it made me really curious about whether there was kind of a common definition of what we meant by resurrection, because it seemed like there was, and that made me want to tease it out a bit. And as I was doing research, I learned about federal funding that was made available to landowners in Arkansas as a response to the rediscovery of the ivory-billed woodpecker. And this would allow landowners and farmers to create wetland habitat on their land. And one of the farmers I reached out to who had enlisted in this program created a wetland out of a former rice farm. And he had started seeing roseate spoonbills showing up every spring around Easter and nesting there. And they'd stay until about Labor Day. And these are birds that would typically nest much farther south along the Gulf or in Florida, and had experienced a lot of habitat degradation and were kind of fleeing the effects of climate change and finding a safer place to have their babies on these farms. And they just kind of unlocked this feeling in me of the unexpected outcomes that can come from trying to take care of the places and the creatures that we love, that these habitats were encouraged for one species and ended up making a home for another species. And I loved that element of just the sheer surprise that these birds were to people in that part of Arkansas.
Well, also, there's something about a pink bird that's always a surprise, you know?
Yeah, they're gorgeous. They're really strange looking. And I think they just became emblematic to me in a way of kind of the kind of story I wanted to tell in this book.
Now, this collection of essays offers a variety of ways to look at climate change and the natural world around us, starting back when you were very young and the daughter of a Methodist preacher. In The Charged World, the very first essay, you talk about one of the great challenging situations your father faced, a real catastrophe. So I wonder if you'd tell us about that.
Yeah, the book begins when my dad is a really young pastor. He's like 26, 27, something like that. And he's serving a pair of churches in East Tennessee and Western Kentucky, and he's away at a church summer camp, and he gets a call that there in his congregation, there was a group of kids that had been rolling this grain auger across a field, and they got too close to a live wire, and it electrocuted half of the boys, and the other boys were in the hospital. And there were two boys in particular that were brothers, and their mom, and they were in the church, and one of the boys died, and the other boy was okay. And my dad got the call to go and visit these boys' mother. And he's so young and so inexperienced, and driving to their house to meet with the mom and just trying to figure out what he could possibly offer her in this time, probably just kind of feeling like an idiot. And he told this story a lot when I was growing up, kind of personally, and he also told it a lot in the church as part of a sermon. And the opening essay is me kind of revisiting the story, watching the way the story changes as he revisits it over time, kind of depending on what context it's in or what new meaning he's found from this story. But the story ends with him arriving at this grieving mother's house and her opening the door and hugging him and saying, "I know that my son's death was not God's will." And he said, at that moment, I felt like the church had helped her. Mm-hmm. And I like that story a lot, and kind of where he lands with that story, because I think it shows that his relationship with faith and with the church is kind of always navigating, renegotiating, finding new meaning. And I think that's a real expression of the kind of pastor he was and the kind of dad he was for me growing up.
Well, you take that metaphor, and you also use the metaphors of power, light, electricity, and you expand them throughout these essays so beautifully. And you weave the strands of faith, motherhood, and how we interact with the climate crisis.
Yeah, I had a hard time, I think, through the process of this book, I was articulating to myself why I saw these things as entwined. And at the beginning, I'm thinking about having children, and there's kind of a lot conceptually going on.
Oh, yeah.
Thinking about bringing a child into the world that seems so pitched toward catastrophe. And also, my husband and I are coming from different faith traditions and getting married right around the time my dad is leaving the church and retiring. And that inspired a lot of renegotiating and reconsidering what faith would look for us, and for if we were to have a child, what it would look like in our kids' lives. But then I think as I wrote the book, I started to really see living through environmental collapse, living through, you know, seeing the alignment of the white Christian church in particular with systems of power, and seeing raising children as part of the same project, which is to constantly being expanding the community of people that you're involved in, constantly expanding your concerns beyond yourself. And so I think these themes kind of started out organically as I was considering bringing a kid into the world. And then as I lived through the writing of the book, they became a little bit more grounded in my life and in the life of the people I'm talking to for the book too.
And you write so much about language, and you write about it so beautifully. And I wonder, would you say a few words about growing up within liturgical language? I think that kind of gives you a real leg up as a writer. You know, there is a kind of grandeur in that language we hear every Sunday, no matter what our faith tradition. And you talk yourself about what it was like to grow up within a tradition of repetition and storytelling.
Yeah, I thought of church is getting to kind of hear an essay that my dad wrote every week. Mm-hmm. And he had a pretty standard structure. You know, he would have an event that had happened in the news recently that was troubling him. He'd have the scripture that he's pulling from the lectionary. He'd be bringing commentary in from other writers and theologians that he admired. And then often he'd try to bring in something like a song or a poem or something a little bit more light, you know, to open it up, give it some space. And so I think that structure really spoke to me. I kind of, it's really ingrained. And I'm always kind of working against any potential temptation to write a sermon while also being really, really grateful for kind of that gift of living in that form growing up and feeling so assured in it. I think as far as the language of the church itself, what I find really inspiring about it is that there are these words that can just be wells of meaning that are really laden with meaning, and that we know because of the centuries of church history that we can keep revisiting them, keep digging into them, keep challenging them, and keep coming to new meanings. And I think that's the whole gift of writing and the gift of living as a person of any kind of faith. It kind of provides a landscape and a language that you can live in and continue to grow in.
It's so funny because I've read a couple of novels lately that both feature sermons. Mm. And it's like the writers were just waiting to get to that and really cut loose, you know? So yeah, it's like we're all frustrated sermonizers.
Yeah, and I think I came up in a particular, my dad's a particular kind of person, and he's a pretty quiet preacher. I think he wrote by ear, and he always felt like sermons were supposed to be written by ear. And I think he kind of resisted the sermoniness of a sermon. So his revelations were always really quiet and subtle, and any instructions he was giving were more like instructions he was giving to himself. And so I think I always love reading books that have a little bit more of an outlandish preacher character or louder sermons, but that certainly wasn't what I grew up in.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Martha Park. Her new book is World Without End, Essays on Apocalypse and After. Now, you moved back home to attend church for your father's last year as a minister there, so you could see him preach every Sunday. So talk about that. That is such an act of devotion and commitment.
Yeah, I hadn't gone to church since I left home for college at 18, really at all. And then when my dad told me he was going to be retiring, it was earlier than I expected. And I just felt this intense disorientation that I didn't know what his leaving the church would mean for my relationship with the church moving forward or for my relationship with faith. And I started to realize how much my understanding of faith was really grounded in and kind of attached to him. Mm-hmm. And that just seemed like something that if I didn't really make right with it, it was going to mess me up. And I wanted to be there to just kind of have the time to experience this transition with him also. I think him being a pastor growing up, it always felt like a family kind of endeavor that we were really in this together. And I wanted to be in the end with him also and be alongside him for that. I think I went into the experience thinking it was going to bring me to somewhere more concrete in my own experience, what I wanted from faith or where I saw myself fitting into church. And that's not really what happened. And I'm gratefully exploring that lesson as well in the book.
Can I ask you to elaborate on one thing that I really loved? There was a moment one Sunday morning where your father was going to preach from the book of Revelation and he had all the children leave.
Yes. Well, that's what I remembered. I remembered him preaching one time from the book of Revelation and him asking all the children to leave. And my understanding of that was because he didn't want us to be spooked by it. And then when I was working on that essay, I always, if I'm going to publish an essay and he's in it, I always give it to him beforehand to make sure I'm not getting something wrong or whatever. And he said, I remember that Sunday. I was not going to preach about the book of Revelation. I wanted to quote one of my favorite books where it said, "We're all bastards, but God loves us anyway." And I don't know why I remember it. It's just one of those weird things. I always remembered that that was his one sermon about Revelation. Then it turned out that I actually have no memories of him preaching from the book of Revelation. And I married a man who grew up in the evangelical church and whose experience of faith was very heavy with Revelation. And so I think I'm kind of exploring how that manifests in our relationship as well, that I had basically no experience with that book of the Bible and that his was pretty heavy on his mind.
And then you didn't read it till you were in your 30s, right?
Right, yeah.
So I love that story.
Yeah, he's a good fact checker. It's annoying.
But how handy.
Right, yeah.
But you're not just going home in this book. You're also going out in the world and you visit some intriguing attractions along the way. And one of them is the Ark Encounter, for example. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about making that pilgrimage.
Yeah, so the Ark Encounter is in Kentucky, not too far from where my husband grew up in Owensboro. And as soon as I heard about it, it just felt like this kind of physical manifestation of like a theology or a worldview. And I thought, it's not that often that you just get to go into a theme park devoted to understanding the world wholly and completely in one way. Mm-hmm. And just the fact that it was so close to where he grew up, it was very close to the kind of theology he grew up with. I just really wanted to go. And it was like his life mission for us not to go there. And I one out and we went, and it was the last trip we made before COVID, which was such a weird, he was like, I really would have chosen something else.
Yeah.
But it was just a fascinating experience. And one of the reasons I wanted to visit the Ark Encounter stemmed from an essay I read by Megan O'Giblin, who's a writer that was a young Earth creationist. And she described it as kind of a glitzy attempt to bewitch unbelievers. And I just thought, this does not sound like a place that's going to appeal to people who aren't already massively bought into this way of thinking. And I guess that's what I wanted to see was, is there anything here that seems to have a person like me in mind, a person who's not so certain about where they fit in with faith? It didn't feel like that. It felt like mostly a kind of a place for confirmation to feel like you're part of a group and that you're on solid ground. And I didn't feel like I was thought of in that, in that experience.
And you thought that it was a place where questions of global warming did not exist.
Right. Yeah. They tend to see climate change, I guess, as part of a larger cycles in the Earth's climate, not necessarily man-made, but if it's kind of like, if it is man-made, it's all part of God's plan and you can't do anything about it. So there's kind of a fatalism about climate change there. And there was an exhibit about climate that was closed when we were there that I was really hoping to see.
Oh, too bad.
Yeah. But there's a lot of just kind of rewriting science, kind of using what they interpret as the science of Genesis to kind of rewrite an understanding of contemporary science to match their worldview, which is what they say people who, quote, believe in science are doing with their evidence. They see it as kind of a tit for tat.
And then you made a trip to the Scopes Monkey Trial reenactment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in Dayton, Tennessee, every year they cycle through a few different scripts, but kind of reenact the Scopes trial there in the courthouse. And I was just really curious about, I think a lot of my experience that I find most meaningful is in growing up in faith is the idea that you can reinterpret something or revisit a story and find something new there. Mm-hmm. And I was really interested in the tension between that and just reenacting something over and over again. It seemed kind of intent on continually applying the Scopes trial's relevance without kind of revisiting what meaning making we're doing around this historical event. It seemed very intent on it being relevant, but not having any new findings or new stories for us. And I was really interested in that.
And I was so interested to read how you found that there was an effort to make a Tower of Babel that came to naught.
I think it may still be happening. I'm not sure. But that's what the Ark Encounter creators are planning, to build a Tower of Babel on the same property as the Ark Encounter. So they're kind of working their way through Genesis. They have the Creation Museum and the Ark Encounter, and their next project is the Tower of Babel, which is really baffling.
Yes. And yet I would love to see it.
I mean, I know. I'll be there.
I know. We can meet. I mean, but you write so much about language. That seems to me to be a natural for you.
I still don't understand their reasoning for recreating the Tower of Babel, but I'll be really curious to see what they do there.
Because it's like 180 degrees, you know, from mm-hmm. preservation to explosion of difference.
Mm-hmm. That is an endeavor that I am just kind of curiously waiting to see. There's a lot on their website trying to explain kind of their reasoning for Babel, but even on their website, they're like, this might seem like a confusing choice, and it is.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Martha Park. Her new book is World Without End, Essays on Apocalypse and After. Well, I love the way you go from death to birth in the last essay, Wound Care, which is about caring for yourself after the birth of your son, James.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about that. Pain and language are all bound together for you.
Yeah, so that essay, it's a weird one. It's pretty different from the other ones in the book. It ends in a really personal place. And my editor kept saying, you know, you don't have to include this. You know, it's really, really personal. But it felt important to me that mm-hmm. the book was not just things I learned about faith from my dad. And that my own personal experience brought me to, you know, the place where I end up in the book. And I spend a lot of time thinking about faith in the book, and I really land in my body in this experience of birth, of a traumatic birth experience. And it felt important that I'm not just in my brain all the time or thinking about wisdom I've gotten from other people, but really inhabiting the wisdom I've found from being a body in the world. And so the essay is kind of stems from an effort to figure out what is a birth story, what would my birth story be, and just really not being able to find any kind of narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of looking outward to narrative itself. And I started reading this book called The Body in Pain by Elaine Scarry. And in that book, she's thinking about the move from the Hebrew Bible to the New Testament as an expression of how people understood God in relation to their bodies. And so, you know, in the Old Testament, there's these scenes of wounding the human body where people have leprosy or they're turned into a pillar of salt or they wrestle with an angel and get a hip injury. You know, that's kind of the encounter with the divine in the Hebrew Bible. And she writes about in the New Testament that being kind of flipped on its head, and the relationship with the sacred is one of healing the blind, you know, that bringing people, dead people back to life. And so I was really interested in that as a narrative, the kind of reversal as a narrative structure. So that essay is just kind of playing with all of those ideas as I'm trying to move toward a birth story that I can live in, even if it's not a traditional narrative arc.
Well, I love that you pull from Octavia Butler, who says God is change.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. I've always been really comfortable with uncertainty and with change. And I wanted my experience kind of going to church and thinking about faith to maybe bring me somewhere that felt a little bit more certain or unchanging.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so grateful for her phrase pretty much every day. I don't think anything from my experience could be truer about an experience of the sacred, is that it's an expression of change, or that change is an expression of the sacred.
But I also love that your husband says God is with us in our bewilderment. I mean, that is perfect.
Yeah. I think, you know, that essay for me, it's been really lovely to hear the way it resonates with people, even coming from really different experiences. One class I visited, a woman talked about having had a hysterectomy, and that this essay kind of spoke to that experience more than anything else she'd read. And I think more than it being about birth in particular, it's just about the experience of the way that life ruptures us and the way we put ourselves back together. It still means a lot to me, you know, as I move forward and am still living in and processing our experience 5 years ago today.
Of course. Happy birthday to James.
It means a lot to me, and it means a lot to me to share it with people.
Well, this is a wonderful book. It's challenging in some ways, it's consoling in others, and it's just rich in wisdom. We've been talking with Martha Park, who is the author of World Without End, Essays on Apocalypse and After. You can meet her Thursday, September 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Martha, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for talking.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Allison Alsup and Jessica Kinnison present a free writing workshop in conjunction with the Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival, Saturday, September 6th at 10 a.m. at Baldwin & Company. Pre-registration is encouraged. Michael Burt, Michael the Wildlife Detective, presents a story time and signs The Little Lost Alligator, Saturday, September 6th at 11 at Garden District Bookshop. Kathleen Kaska signs Murder at the Pontchartrain, Saturday, September 6th at 6 at Octavia Books. Shannon Kelly Atwater signs her new children's book, Faye Dodo, Saturday, September 6th at 1 at Blue Cypress Books. Tom Andes reads from and signs his first detective novel, Wait There Till You Hear From Me, along with Crescent City Books editor Jeff Munsterman, Sunday, September 7th at 9 at Bar Redux. Doors open at 8. Ebony Liddell signs You've Got a Place Here Too, an anthology of love stories set at HBCUs, Tuesday, September 9th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Michael Warner signs Charles Whitfield Richards, The Artist and His Circle, Wednesday, September 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Robert W. Hastings signs The American Alligator, Wednesday, September 10th at 6 at Octavia Books. Phoebe Hayes and Margaret Simon sign Were You There? Thursday, September 11th at 6 at Octavia Books. Laura Pegram appears in conversation with Josie Abugov and signs Sing the Truth, short stories from the Quayle Journal, Thursday, September 11th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Donna Poniatowski-Sims signs Donna's Bar and Grill, New Orleans, Friday, September 12th at 9 at Chickiwawa. Don't forget to mark your calendar and get tickets now for The Last Laugh, Wit, Wisdom, and 10 Years of the Walker Percy Weekend. That's coming up September 19th and 20th in St. Francisville. Headquartered at Conundrum Bookstore, the weekend includes panel discussions, a lunchtime book club, the traditional progressive front porch tour, and bourbon tasting, the Taste of South supper, and an appearance by Sonny Landreth. Organizers say this is likely the last time they'll produce this event, so if you love Walker Percy, better go. For more information, visit walkerpercyweekend.org. Congratulations to Louisiana's new state poet laureate, Gina Ferrara, who follows Allison Pellegrin in the post. Gina is an associate professor of English at Delgado Community College and the author of 5 poetry collections. The most recent, A Miss, was published in 2023. She lives in New Orleans and received both her BA and MFA from UNO. She will hold that post for 2 years. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.